Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. And I can't tell you how delighted I am once again to introduce Dr. Peter Pronovost, MD, PhD, to all of the Forum Club. When he talked to us last in 2010, we so valued his perspective and insight into healthcare. Well, Peter has continued to be a world-renowned physician and expert in patient safety, a critical care physician, and a prolific medical researcher with over 800 peer-reviewed publications. He was named one of the 100 most influential people in the world by Time magazine. He received the MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant and is a leader in the growth of digital health solutions, including telehealth and virtual health. And in 2011, he was elected to the National Academy of Medicine. Just one personal note, yet it was a very impactful note for me. Dr. Pronovost and I founded the Johns Hopkins Medicine Armstrong Institute for Patient Safety and Quality. And Peter was our director and took us from where we were to national leadership and got recognition nationally for that leadership. Today, Dr. Pronovost will share his insights on how healthcare harms too often, costs too much, and improves too slowly. And most importantly, he will share what you and I can do to help ourselves improve the value of care we receive. I'm very, very proud to introduce the Chief Clinical Transformation Officer at University Hospitals in Northeast Ohio, no less, right around Cleveland, Dr. Peter Pronovost.
Michael, thank you for that very generous introduction. Humility is one of the most powerful virtues. I think it's a virtue without which we can't improve. And yet it's a virtue that is too rare in healthcare, perhaps all of society. I happen to be easily and often humbled, not because I have an 18-year-old daughter, but she's quite good at it. But a few months ago, I was giving a talk, and I was on call in the ICU, and I was left the ICU early and had to catch a plane. I had a tight schedule, so they had a driver for me, a 65, 68-year-old gentleman in a tuxedo with a sign that says, Dr. Pronovost. And I probably looked like I was in call in the ICU. I was a bit disheveled. And I get off the plane, and I said, okay, come on, sir, let's go. I got a tight schedule. And he looks at me and says, no, Sonny, I'm waiting for a world-famous doctor. I said, okay, could I go along for the ride? I'd like you to think about the words, I will. I will. Because what we are going to share today truly threatens the American dream. And my coming here tonight, and I'm delighted Mike in the forum asked me, and thank you deeply, but it's not just to hear a great talk, hopefully a great talk, it's so that we do something when we leave here. So at the end, we may take some questions about your I will statements. But let me see, how many of you have been or your loved ones have been the victim of a medical error? Many, many hands. How many of you serve on a hospital or health system board? Quite a few of you. You see, though healthcare does miracles every day, we cure cancers, as we were talking about, we heal hearts, we mend minds, the reality today is preventable harm is at least the third leading cause of death. Think about that for a second. Third. And if you add misdiagnosis, if you add not controlling diabetes, if you add not controlling blood pressure, it is by far the number one cause of death in America. Medicine today leaves 3 in 10 people on average leaving their interaction with healthcare feeling I wasn't respected, I wasn't listened to, and frightened because I don't know what to do when I leave. And medicine today squanders a third of every dollar we spend on healthcare, over $3 trillion, so $1 trillion wasted on things that don't get people well. Collectively, it's $1 trillion. More locally, it's $10,000 per household in America. That's more than the net worth in urban or rural America. And so that's money that is not going to STEM or preschool or supporting these great students. And so we have to take a look at it. Because if you look at every payer of healthcare, the federal government, state governments, employers, or us as individuals, our healthcare costs are going up more than our revenues, whatever those are. And that's the business people in the room. That's not a long-term survivable plan. And with our high deductible plans, which are common now, they're all set at $1,500. But half of Americans will go bankrupt if they have a $500 healthcare bill. They don't have the cash to do it. And healthcare is the biggest cause of personal bankruptcy now. So we have to begin to get this right. So what's holding us back? Well, I'd like to put forth to you that it's something perhaps simple, but profoundly human. And that is, it's the stories that we tell ourselves. The stories. You see, stories are the most potent force for change in the world because they define how we act. Whether we see ourselves as powerful, as you all do, or powerless. Whether we see others as competitors or collaborators. You change the story and you change everything. Perhaps the most profound stories were Martin Luther King's story of nonviolent protest or JFK's story, I want a man on the moon. Change the story, you change everything. So I'd like to explore a few stories that I think are holding us back. The first story, and you as board members, I hope drive this, is we still accept harm as inevitable in healthcare. Mike and I learned that story a very painful way. In 2001, on a snowy night in February, in a dark corner of the pediatric ICU, an adorable little girl, Josie King, was taken off of life support and died in her mother's arms. She had been burned, but was ready to go home that day, but a catheter infection sacrificed her. She wasn't alone. In that year, this catheter infection that you may never heard of killed more people in the U.S. than breast or prostate cancer. Let's think about that. A public health problem the size of breast or prostate cancer that we just accepted as the cost of doing business. I was trained, we all learned that when you care for sick people, sometimes little girls like Josie are going to die, and she did. Well, their mother challenged us and said, could you tell me that this won't happen to my other children? Mike and I talked, and we, like many executives or board members, wanted to give them the spiel about how much we're committed, but we couldn't. We had a moral moment. We looked at her and said, I can't tell you it's going to be better, but you deserve an answer, so we will. And we did something at the time that was heretical. We declared a goal of zero infection. Our colleagues thought we were nuts. Peter, at the time, this is Johns Hopkins, we're great, you care for sick people, stuff happens. No, we will be zero. We made a checklist of best practices, started using the checklist 30% of the time, up to 100. We got doctors and nurses to work together and encouraged nurses to question doctors if they weren't using the checklist. We created a management and accountability system so those leaders were accountable for improving performance. And we eliminated infections and then spread that program state by state. And today, my friends, these infections that killed more people than breast or prostate cancer are down 90% across the U.S. and in 15 other countries. Think about that. So we got curious and said, what changed with this effort? Because if we could tap into that, we have a really potent pill. And so we partnered with some anthropologists and interviewed people. And when we were speaking with them, you could see in their eyes what they believed in their hearts. The only thing that changed is they started telling a new story. You see, they all share with us that when they started, they shared words like, oh, these infections are inevitable, and I'm just a, and fill in the blank. I'm just a resident. I'm just a nurse. I'm just a physician. And when they got to zero, they said, no, I am powerful, and we will get to zero. And so we unpacked that and said, well, what makes us tell new narratives in the world, in healthcare? And so we, again, interviewed people, and what we found was two simple things. Turns out there's a great research in the social sciences that it's not just healthcare, it's everything. It's believing and belonging. You see, somebody believes that you can get to zero and infects that belief in others. And if you want an example of that, take Roger Bannister, who broke the four-minute mile in 1954. He was told that for 2,000 years, it's impossible to do that. Indeed, scientists said you will die trying. And you may know he broke that record. You may not know, the next year, 12 people broke that record. The year after that, 156 people broke it. And the last New York Marathon, a guy ran the four-minute mile for the whole 26 miles, and high school kids are breaking the minute. So what changed in 1954? Nothing but their beliefs. Bannister wasn't constrained by that impossibility, and in doing so, freed us all up to break that impossibility. The second thing is belonging to peer learning communities, not judging communities, learning communities. As an example, how many of you have seen Mary Poppins? Well, as you probably know, a really prominent feature of that movie or play is birds chirping all throughout the place when she's skipping in the park, when she's sliding down. And that's because in the late 40s, London was full of two types of melodious songbirds, the red robins and the blue tights. And they used to peck through the tops of the milk containers that were left on people's stoops, and they sucked the fat out, and they were really plump, really well-nourished birds. And they were singing to their heart's content until the milk companies changed the tops of the containers. They went from cardboard and steeple to aluminum and flat. And both birds were equally smart. And a few of both birds learned how to peck through the tops of those containers. But the red robins went extinct. And the blue tights thrive today. And the difference is the red robins were solitary birds. They have their stoop or their corner. We may call it our department, our political beliefs, our own neighborhood. And that wisdom never spread through the community. The blue tights were flocking birds. They fly strong and proud together. And so that wisdom quickly disseminated, and they thrive to this day. And this believing and belonging, as I said, isn't just healthcare, it's education reform. There was a UC Berkeley math professor, Uri Traceman, and he noticed that minority students were failing intro to math at a much higher rate than privileged students. And he got curious, and again, this humility and curiosity values you'll see permeate this work, and partnered with, again, a sociologist, and found that the failing students studied alone. So, and they didn't have encouragement among their peers. So when they got a bad grade, they suffered their shame by themselves. The successful students studied in peers. And in doing so, they got much more than an education. They got the support and the encouragement and the love from others. So Uri wanted to change that. And all he did was formed a peer study group amongst the failing students. And he called it an honors program. Just the name showed he believed in them. That's all he did. And then he had a couple senior students come down, which I love to see you guys are doing, to the first-year students and say, you're just as smart as us. You can get through this. And within 6 months, the graduation rates of those failing students were exactly the same, actually a bit ahead of the privileged students. simply by believing and belonging. Second narrative that we need to change is, though we say healthcare is a system, it is the furthest thing from a system. You see, a system is a set of parts interacting to achieve a goal. Healthcare has built the parts, but they're siloed. They're like the Red Robins. They're not integrated, and they aren't aligned to achieve a goal. Indeed, it's one of the reasons I joined University Hospitals, because they had the parts, and we were committed to be a truly functioning health system. But let me give you examples of what a system would look like. It would be organized around the needs of patients. I don't know how many of you have had cancer, but the journey of a patient with cancer is often deplorable. There's great data that the therapy you get depends almost solely on the first type of physician you get referred to. If you get to a radiation oncology, you get radiation. If you get to a surgery, you get cut. If you get a medical oncologist, you get chemotherapy. And navigating that journey isn't always aligned around your needs. It's around the individual physician needs. That needs to change. We have too much what I call mindless variation in care, variation that's not based on evidence, but not enough mindful variation, variation that's based on your individual needs and the hunch that your biology, your genes, your life story is different and I need to change it. But that mindful variation imparts an obligation to learn, which we hardly ever do. I was learning and studying what a system looked like when Mike and I were at Johns Hopkins, and I visited an aircraft carrier, and they're the prototypical example of something working as a system. And indeed, I was speaking to the admiral at the time, complaining how hard it is to lead with residents, and the admiral looks at me and says, "Sonny, stop complaining and stop and start leading. We are out in the middle of the ocean on a ship the size of a football field, pitching 30 degrees. We land planes every 33 seconds with enough bombs to blow us all up. Our average education is a high school degree, and we turn the whole ship over every 6 months. Don't give me about your residents. Start creating a management system." Right? And as I was talking to that admiral, there was a gentleman sweeping the deck next to him. And as you may know, on the power hierarchy, that gentleman is way below the admiral. But on the safety hierarchy, they're exactly equal. Because if there's a plane or debris on that runway when the plane comes down every 3 seconds and it hits it, it blows up. It's just the same dynamic as our environmental services workers, the housekeepers in a hospital. Really far below the CEO on power, but equal on safety. Because if that room isn't clean, and some of you may have been victim of this, you get C. diff or MRSA. So I asked that gentleman what job he did and was stunned. He stood up tall and proud, looked me in the eye and said, "Sir, I help planes take off and land safely to serve the mission of the United States." I said, "Wow." I left that, walked into a hospital, now indeed several hospitals, and asked the housekeepers what job they do. And what do you think they said? They looked shameful, put their head down, and said, "I clean the rooms." I said, "No, you don't. You prevent infections." Right? Be proud. But that's a leadership failure for not creating the culture that those people feel connected to this purpose in healthcare that we are so privileged to be able to serve. I asked the people who answer calls in a health system, "What job do you do?" They say, "I answer the phones." I say, "No, you don't. You cure cancer. You connect people to care. You heal." And healthcare needs to create this kind of leadership culture that engages everyone. The third thing these health systems do, or systems, is they have much tighter management and accountability systems. And all of you who serve on any boards, you know your financial systems are incredibly tight. Your quality systems are often underdeveloped, non-existent. When Mike and I started this institute, we made a decree that our board quality committee will function with the same rigor as the board finance committee. What that means is that anywhere care is delivered, we will have quality measures just like you would have budget or financial oversight, and our leaders will report using the equivalent of an MD&A. Those of you who are in finance at UH, we now call this management analysis in action, where the leaders have to be accountable for What's your performance and what are you going to do about it? I'm delighted to say we put that in throughout Johns Hopkins, and with Tom Zenti's leadership in UH in 2 months, there wasn't this kind of discipline. The whole health system now is being managed to that. But we need to work as a system. The third narrative that we need to begin to look at is value is not my responsibility. And by value, what I mean is the quality of care plus your experience of that care over the annual total cost of care. You see, we too often worry about the cost of a widget or the cost of this thing, but those of us who pay for care, and we all do, or employers or governments, are looking at annual cost of care. And as you all probably know, it's crushing state budgets right now in an unsustainable way. But we haven't viewed it as our responsibility. And that checklist that you had in your table is our view to say, how do we eliminate defects in value, just like we eliminated defects and bloodstream infections that kill little girls? And we all have a role in eliminating these defects. The first defects we'll talk about is, how do we all stay well? That is, how often do we nourish ourselves? Do we move or exercise? Do we refresh or reduce stress? Do we connect? And do we prevent diseases? You may know 80% of our wellness, of our health, are defined by the habits you create every day. Habits that we're often mindless, not mindful, but we need to make sure we begin to do. So for things like nourishing, making sure on your checklist that we avoid sugars and refined flours and eat fruits and vegetables and lean proteins. That we, as during our dinner last night, Ernie, put our salad dressings and sauces on the side because you often triple your calories and your fat. There's a simple habit like doing that. That we move, we get into a habit of exercising and doing some weights or resistance training. That we connect in forums like this and get support from being with our peers, and we either meditate or take care of our souls to reduce our stress. And importantly, that we do wellness and prevention. Nationally, about 20% of people get an annual wellness exam, and we know doing that makes us healthy. It's maybe 30% of women get a mammogram. Maybe half the people get a colonoscopy, or women get cervical cancer screening. And what that means, in really concrete terms, is that there are many people today with those cancers that could be prevented. Second domain of our checklist of defects is, how well do we get well? That is, if we have a chronic disease, what are we doing about it? What we know right now, let's take diabetes. 40% of diabetics are not diagnosed. They have a high blood sugar, but somehow their doctor didn't connect that to a label and then treatment for diabetes. That needs to change. About half of people with chronic diseases are on evidence-based therapies. Amongst diabetics, 13% have their A1C, their blood pressures, and their LDL at the optimal range. 13%. And well over 80% of them have needless emergency department visits or hospital visits because we're not controlling that. Indeed, there's some estimates that about 30 to 40% of hospital admissions for medical diseases could be eliminated if we managed these kinds of diseases. But we haven't yet. The third domain is, how well do we manage an acute condition? And that checklist, my friends, is also really important for you as you go through your wellness journey. The first item on the checklist is, is the care coordinated with your primary care doctor? Right? There's so much tension of when people come into the hospital and they're not connected to their primary care doctor, or they leave the hospital and 2% of those people have a primary care visit scheduled within a week. I mean, if you're sick enough to be in the hospital, you should be plugged in, but we haven't had that narrative because my job in the hospital was just in the hospital. Is what you're being recommended appropriate? There's overwhelming data that almost every procedure that you look at, 30% of them aren't needed. 30%, whether it's cancer care, hip replacement, cardiovascular intervention, but we do those things. And as you may know, which is why many of you go to cancer centers of excellence, you go to a cancer center of excellence, between 25 and 30% of the time, they will change your diagnosis or therapy. 25 to 30% of the time. And yet we don't standardize those protocols. And finally, are you going to the optimal site of service? Right? We have this narrative in medicine that success is healing in the hospital. And success, my friends, is being healthy at home. And so thinking of home as the default location, and we can do so much more by having people not be in the hospital, but giving them, you could do now ICU level care at home or hospital at home, or doing things in an ambulatory center that are a tenth the cost of an expensive hospital, and being mindful of that. And finally, is the provider you're going to appropriate and high value? I'll share with you, when you are having any kind of procedure, probably the most important piece of data for you to know, and it's not publicly available, is how many cases that hospital and that surgeon did. How many cases? Because there's, for everything we've looked at, there's a linear relationship. Not surprisingly, you do more, you get better outcomes, but it's not publicly available. There was a study in California that looked at high-risk surgeries where the difference between a high and a low volume is like a 70% mortality difference. So not trivial difference, enormous difference. 60% of those hospitals did one or two of those procedures, literally one or two a year. And for 80% of them, there was a high-volume hospital within 30 miles. But most people, even educated people, don't even know that because they don't think, I guess, that someone would be doing one or two of something that almost on you and not make that known that you're taking a greater risk. So, my friends, we all have a role in this journey to drive value together. I'm actively working now throughout the UH system to pull all these levers to drive value, particularly in the employee health plan, because that is the model for value in the U.S. healthcare system. Because as a large employer, we have full risk for all those patients. They have to get care in our UH network. We control the wellness and the disease management programs, and we control the incentives for physicians. So it's the only model that you could literally pull all those levers to see how could we eliminate defects in value. But I'll share with you, throughout my journey to drive value in healthcare, I learned something very simple and yet profound. That the secret of healthcare is love. And by love, I don't mean the 58-year marriage that Mike and Ann Armstrong are celebrating or the 22-year marriage that I celebrate. For sure, there's love in that. But by love, I mean what the psychologist Barbara Friedrichsen talks about in her book, Love 2.0, of micromoments. You see, Barbara studies the biology of love, literally what makes oxytocin spike. Oxytocin is the cuddle hormone. And what she found is love is micromoments of positive connection between two or more people. Micromoments. The idea is I feel warm towards you or you feel warm towards me and we create energy. Love is the relationship you may have with your primary care physician when they listen to your very personal troubles, or me listening to a colleague who made a mistake or is scared, or saying to that EVS worker, thank you for preventing infections. You save lives. Or a respectful smile for that homeless person who's asking you for money. You see, change progresses at the speed of trust. And this big change that we're working on in healthcare is the sum of 100 or 1,000 small ones. And every one of those is only possible by creating those micro moments. So my friends, I hope you leave here today and go make some micro moments. And I'd love to hear your I will statements. Thank you for the privilege of speaking with you.
I'm just going to give him a 1.5 minute break by telling an aircraft carrier story that he was referring to aircraft carriers in my career with the Hughes Aerospace Company. One of our largest customers was the Marine Corps, and we got awarded for our product safety and quality. And part of that was that I got to fly an F-18 on and off of an aircraft carrier out in the Pacific Ocean in the back seat. So we were on our third landing, and the commander of the ship asked us after a tour to go to lunch. So when we sat down to lunch, I said, you know, that tour was fascinating. You have 3,000 teenagers working on this ship who are dutiful and dedicated and bored. We just came out with a new product, and it's called Direct TV. And I'd like to install Direct TV throughout your ship. And he looked at me and he said, Mr. Armstrong, I accept on one condition. And I said, General, what would that be? He said, I'm in charge of programming. Okay. All right, we'll go to the questions now. And there's a plethora of questions. We'll never get to all of them, so you can come up and talk to Peter after the session. But there were two from students, and the first one I'd like to ask Peter, how would you suggest that leadership culture can appropriately be created in hospitals to deliver that safety that you talked about?
Yeah, really important question. And, you know, we act as if leadership is this nebulous thing, but leaders and leadership matter deeply. We all have a responsibility. For you, each of us as individuals, we are all leaders, because leaders is a set of behaviors. And so I would encourage you every day, at the end of the day, to reflect of whether you had a good day. And you're going to define good days however you want. A good day for someone like me is, did I live healthy? Did I connect with my family? Did I encourage and believe in others in the organization? And did I live up to my accountability responsibility for that leadership role? For all of us, when we see injustices or things that aren't right, having the courage to speak out and address it. C.S. Lewis has this beautiful quote that says, courage is not one virtue, it's the form of all virtues at the testing point. And many of us are at the testing point every day, and the question is, will we have the courage? And then finally, being drawn to and going to organizations where leaders inspire and encourage people rather than diminish them and shoot down ideas. Because you could walk into that any organization, and if you feel it's a diminishing organization, it's going to be really hard to thrive there, because the leader's not setting that tone. And we're either going to have to work to get the leader changed or go to a different organization. So select out those places where people inspire you and you could flourish.
Because I know the answer to this question, I'm going to...
You know the answer to all the questions,
no,
my
I
friend.
Don't. A student asked this. Peter, what inspired you to become part of the medical field and so involved in the leadership of healthcare?
Yeah, thanks, Mike. My journey, like I think so many journeys, often begins out of hardship. When I was a fourth-year medical student, my father died of a misdiagnosis. And he came home to die at home with hospice. And at the time, hospice was rather pathetic. And he writhed in pain for a week, so much that my wife couldn't sleep in the same bedroom with my dad because he was literally in agony. And so I held vigil there. And the palliative care team said, oh, we've given him but the prescription was for narcotics. There's nothing else we can do. I know how ridiculous that is now. And that moment, I became convinced that healthcare or patients deserve more than our healthcare often gives them. And it's not because there's bad people. There's really, really good people in healthcare. It's because we put them in bad systems. And we need to begin to think about how do we change the systems and the culture. I went on to train and get a PhD. And like many academics, and you saw my CV, the goal of academics is often adding new knowledge or publishing. And though I learned to do that, that didn't really inspire me. What inspired me was having an impact, making a difference in the lives of people. And sure, I could tell the story in publishing, but I'd much more save lives. And finally, nothing touched me more when that little girl's mother asked me, will this happen to her other daughters? And in part, I think that touched me so deeply because that little girl was born 2 days from my daughter, and they looked hauntingly similar. And eerily, she died on my birthday. And so we had this weird connection to say we patients deserve better, and I was going to work to change the system to make it so.
Now, this next question you all expect. And it's because we've just had this modest little situation at our local hospital, Maples Community Hospital. And the good news, of course, is much of that has been settled. The bad news is there's still some very important aspects to the relationship to the community. Now the question. What do you think, Peter, of the trend towards hospitalist-based systems in hospitals?
Yeah, great question, Mike. As a student of safety, and I know many of you are engineers, one of the things you need to recognize that any time you change a system, you may defend against some risks, but you will predictably introduce new risks. And sometimes those risks are even greater. So a hospitalist largely emerged out of the need to control hospital cost and hospital length of stay because, and there's a real need for that. 25% of hospitals have negative margins. The cost of hospitals are going up 7% and their revenues are going up 4.5%, and the average hospital margin is 1.5%. So we have to manage these costs, and some admissions are what are called observations. And so if you don't get them out in 24 hours, the hospital loses money. So there's a need to manage people in the hospital. And if your primary care doctor is in the office and comes in late at night, you lose part of that time to do it. The risk of, so in part, having someone there who could coordinate with the primary care, it might make sense. The problem was they are too often isolated from the primary care. They don't communicate back with them. And so the primary care is left knowing what the heck happened here. And it, I think there were leadership failures. What we should have done is bring those two parties together and lay out the problem to be solved. We know great care, as you saw on my checklist, is anchored in primary care and always connected to primary care because that doctor who's known you for 20 years has wisdom that needs to be incorporated in the care process. At the same time, we have to manage our making people in this very expensive thing we call the hospital. And there's ways to do that collaboratively. For example, some hospitals put nurse practitioners in there, and the primary care doctor calls them, and they're there managing it, but they're on the phone with them. Some still have the primary care doctor, and others say, okay, I want to be there, but if I can't be there within X period of time, why don't we have the hospital start to look at them, and then we'll communicate. But the key is it's done as a micro moment together to figure out the solution. And different docs are going to want different things. I mean, they know you. Some are going to say, I should be involved in this. I need to be involved in this. I'll get to the hospital early in the morning and we'll do it. Some make standard protocols. Some say use an NP. But to disconnect the primary care from the care that goes on in the hospital by design is a really risky situation.
Now, a much simpler question, Peter, and there's only three or four cards that I'll summarize in one card. Would you please comment on many proposals that are going about now on Medicare for all as a national system?
Yeah, so great question, and you hear that term a ton. What you often don't hear or haven't unpacked is what exactly does that mean? And it could mean a variety of things, of moving more towards the fee-for-service Medicare, which I think is highly unlikely. But many of you might not be aware of, we've grown Medicare, but the largest growth of it is in Medicare Advantage, which is essentially a privatization of Medicare, right? It's insurers who are running the Medicare Advantage plans, and there's some evidence that they do it more effectively and they give better care, and that is the fastest growing part. And so a Medicare for All could be expanding the private sector to do Medicare Advantage, or it might be the fee-for-service that it's the government, you know, CMS running that. I would predict what we'll see is as these policy discussions emerge and you get above the 30,000-foot level and see, okay, what the heck does that really mean? You're going to see a lot more discussion and perhaps different camps forming, because right now it simply means providing access to all people. And the U.S. healthcare system is an anomaly if not providing access to all of our citizens. And almost, not almost, every other developed country provides access from a variety of mechanisms. It could be the private sector to people. I believe that people should have access to healthcare, that in a society as wealthy as ours, that children shouldn't go unimmunized or elderly people shouldn't have access to care. And much like my micro moments, we have to figure out how to finance that. There's plenty of money, most importantly, in this 30% of waste that we're doing things that add no value, that we have to begin. You know, let me share with you an example of the waste. I was looking at patients who are readmitted to the hospital. And I looked at a couple hospitals. In one community, I saw sickle cell patients were by far the most common and had five times more readmissions than any other. Some of these patients were either visiting the emergency department or the hospital 90 times a year. And we know there's 5% of patients that control 50% of the cost, patients like this. So I dug into it and said, how could that be? Sickle cell, there's not that many of them. I thought it would be heart failure. So it turns out in many places there were a sickle cell clinic. And that clinic manager was charged with optimizing their clinic, optimizing the piece, not the system. And if you may know, sickle cell is a disease of pain. Pain is a big, prominent feature. But pain patients take time. They're complex. This clinic decided that any patient who has pain was going to be kicked out of their clinic and told to get care in the emergency department. From that manager's narrow perspective, that made sense. They're optimizing their budget. They have to meet their throughput numbers. From a system perspective, it makes absolutely no sense, right? And so we looked at that and begin to change it. Those sickle cell admissions went down 40%, right? And so that it's that kind of waste that is in the health system. But prior to that, nobody owned value. Everyone was optimizing their piece of the silo. And so there's countless examples where there's resources that are available, but we have to eliminate all this waste that we have. And we all have a responsibility to begin to do that.
Peter, do you believe in the years to come, not way out, but in a few years to come, that we will all have medical implants that will monitor and report our medical health to our medical facilities and doctors?
Yeah, that's a great question. The advances in telemonitoring and digital health are growing at, you know, really remarkable rates. And I would say, you know, probably 5 years ago, the hype of AI was truly hype because we didn't have low-cost ways of integrating and analyzing large data sets. That is completely gone now. It's really inexpensive. There's, like our young students, many people with the skills now who know how to do that. And so the advances are just profound. I'll give you some examples of things we're doing in UH. For those people with diabetes, getting a retinal exam is an important piece because, as you know, with diabetes, you could get eye damage. But it's hard for some people to get access to or to get to an eye doctor. There's now a camera that a primary care or a nurse takes a picture of your retina, automatically read. You get a report on whether you have eye disease or not. Really, really low cost. We are doing in UH post-surgical visits by telemedicine. Because many, if you're doing well, it's hard for you to come in. It's very much patient-centered to stay home. And there's no added cost or fee for patients if they come in. And so we're checking on people when they're at home. We're offering telepharmacy reviews that for our employees where they can review their medicines, staying at home with the pharmacist to make sure they understand that. We're doing telemental health visits, telediabetes education, a whole variety of things, and we're doing monitoring at home. The home monitoring space is growing radically. When I said we have the ability to do ICU-level care at home, that literally is no exaggeration, that we could monitor your heart rate, your blood pressure, your often get glucose or labs non-invasively from putting clips on your fingers. And so you can be at home. You may have a home nurse, but people are monitoring your data just as if you were sitting in a expensive and often impersonal ICU. And so this is, I think, going to offer great promise for driving up value, that is improving quality and your satisfaction, and driving down costs of care.
I saved the last question to be the toughest one because our time has come. So, Peter, you mentioned that healthcare costs are going up much faster than wages growth. And as a result, as you look out into the future, how will the system adapt for the working class people so they can have adequate health care?
Yeah, Mike, great question. So this is could be a whole talk on health economics, but what we saw, and it's with every payer I mentioned, their health care costs are going up. And so for employers, and you all probably realize it, their main way of hedging those costs was to put risk on their employees. And we largely did this through high deductible health plans. So I don't know how many of you have that, but many of these deductibles are $5,000 or $7,000 a year. People who are in this room could afford that. People who have lower incomes, there's no way they could afford that. And what we've seen is we haven't been really scientific. And what I mean, as a matter of fact, I would say we've almost been naively unscientific, that there's overwhelming data that people are very price sensitive. So if I increase your out-of-pocket spend, you will buy less health care. The problem is you buy less needed and non-needed health care. So you may forgo things that actually reduce your annual total cost of care, but you're looking at, I got to pay this out of my pocket. My bank account doesn't survive for that. So it actually compromises care. It's one of the things I mentioned why these employee plans are really the focus of innovation, because at UH, we control that benefit design. So we are being much more surgical in saying, we will not make you have a copay for COPD or diabetic medications because we know taking those are going to keep you out of the emergency room in the hospital. But we may keep copays for other things that are of lower value. And I see the trend right now is we realize that putting the cost and the burden on employees, we've tapped that out. We've probably gone too far. I mentioned the average American could take $500 of a healthcare bill without going declaring bankruptcy. And so I think, and we haven't gotten the bending the cost curve. So we're starting to see moving away from the high deductibles. Some policymakers are thinking perhaps for lower income, completely doing away from high deductibles because it really doesn't make sense. They deny care. Getting much more surgical and scientific about what benefits are paid for and what benefits aren't paid for so that we incentivize eliminating these defects in value that I went, but also getting rid of the waste in the system. And so I think you're going to see a lot more innovation. Now, let me give an example. One of the things I'm working on now at UH, which is all of you may know, primary care doctors are in this every click 15 minutes that they have to see patients. And if you're sick, who would have ever thought you'd design a system where 15 minutes is the unit rather than am I solving your problem? And it would, you know, not equating docs with plumbers, but imagine an electrician or a plumber or a car mechanic comes in and says, oh, it's been up 15 minutes, I'm leaving, or your car's coming out of shop. Okay, well, did you fix the problem? My car still is not driving. No, but your 15 minutes is up, come back next year, right? Like, what are we thinking, right? I mean, but that's the way we design these systems. And so we're launching a pilot where in these high needs patients, some of the 5% that are using the emergency department, they often have social issues of homelessness or lack of transportation or food scarcity. And we have horrific health inequities in this country, as you know, that where you live in your zip code, we could have a 5- to 10-fold variation in infant mortality a mile apart from each other. That's in Baltimore, that's in Cleveland, that's in New York, that's in every urban city because of the demographics of you live. So what we're doing is taking a clinicians, supporting them with nurses and a social worker, and saying, you're off the 15-minute treadmill. We're going to pay you what you got paid last year, or 90% of that, but your incentive is reducing the annual total cost of care for this population. And you figure out how you're going to do that. But we trust you know your patient. So if it is 2 hours you need to spend with your patient, spend 2 hours, because educating the patients with diabetes or meeting mental health needs in the long run is going to be far, far more effective. Now, you would think doctors might not want that, but I'm overwhelmed with requests of doctors who are frustrated in this treadmill to say, I would love to do medicine that way, because that's the way most people went into medicine to practice. And so I think we're going to see some innovations in that way, that the incentives are really for true value, not for this, am I clicking 15-minute intervals and not meeting, you know, doctors are frustrated, the patients are frustrated, and the payers' costs are going up. Mike, if I could leave with a request of the students, because your talks this morning were so inspirational to us all, and that would be to live this quote by Margaret Mead, an anthropologist in the 1920s, who said, never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed people could change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has. So go change the world, my friends.
Thank you, Dr. Peter Protobos. Thank you.